So, welcome to the Where Did the Road Go Midweek podcast. Tonight I'm joined with Joshua Cutchin, Red Pill Junkie, and for the first time, Greg Bishop. Hello, Greg.
Hello. Sorry I was late. I'm glad you didn't start recording till now, and now everybody knows.
Well, we tried to start recording a different show. It just never actually happened.
Oh, lucky me. Like I said, I apologize again profusely.
All right. So our basic theme tonight was going to be the differences between old school UFO research back in like the 50s and 60s and the current crop of how things are done.
Current crop. Bang goes the dynamite.
Well, you know, it all depends on who you look at.
I guess, the people you never hear of, I think, are the ones that are doing the good work because they're not in it for their ego and to have people point at them and say they're wonderful. They're in it because they're passionate about it. And every once in a while, somebody like that gets noticed. Almost not even through any fault of their own. Those are the kind of people I like.
Right, exactly. But it seems like back in the early days of UFO research, I mean, things weren't so dogmatic either because it was a new field. I mean, despite the fact that this phenomena may have been with us forever, it has only been recognized as UFOs since World War II and Roswell and Kenneth Arnold and all that.
You know, it's interesting. It's almost like you'd think that when this particular area of inquiry opened up that it would have a ton of different possibilities, but I almost feel like the inverse has happened. I almost feel like the field started out, you know, after the Arnold sighting, and it was spacemen. And then as we've gotten, you know, as we've gotten farther away from that, in some sense, we've expanded our ideas of what it can be. Of course, I think that, you know, the mainstream still follows the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but some of the ideas that are talked about now, the ones that excite me at least, are a lot broader than that. You'd think that, you know, coming into this field when it was first starting, that there would be more options and it would sort of funnel down to a conclusion, but we actually see quite the opposite happening, in my opinion.
Yeah, That's going on. You know why it started out that way? It's because it was a very good basis in science fiction and people speculating about that beforehand, so that it funneled everybody's ideas about what would the other thing be. It's coming from the sky. It's very advanced. Well, it must be like those, you know, it must be like the Martians and H.G. Wells or all those pulp science fiction magazines from the 30s, 40s. All those covers with, you know, women in tubes and big-headed whatever they are drooling at them. But there was a really good backgrounding in that to begin with, a cultural backgrounding. And now it's, you know, it's not even cultural backgrounding. It's like in everybody's DNA. So you almost can't get away from it, which is unfortunate. I think that would be one of the keys, too. It's like, try your heart. You know, it's the, you know, don't think of a blue elephant. Try your hardest not to think of aliens coming from other planets, and it's really, really hard because
that's a really good point.
But wait a minute, Greg. Isn't it true that one of the things that had a huge impact in the early days of the UFO craze was the Richard Shaver mystery and this whole thing with the Deros and the Terros, you know, and the inner Earth, and how the UFO craft came, you know, the flying saucers came from the inner Earth. So how does that play out? How was that kind of like replaced by the idea that the phenomenon originated in outer space?
I think it started there, and that kind of tried to pull it in another direction. It's just, you know, it didn't have the legs. For some reason, because people are so well tracked. Because no, nobody would see them coming out of the ground. If people saw them coming out of the ground all the time, maybe it might have helped that idea. But no, everybody would they would see they're either coming out of the sky or going back to it or both. They would never see them, and occasionally coming out of this and going into the ocean.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But nobody. I don't think there were too many. I can't think of one. There's probably some of sightings of things coming out of the ground. I think there's some in Puerto Rico in the. Still going on, too, but I guess started around the 80s or something like 70s, 80s, something like that.
Well, the idea, the trope has never really left us, though. I mean, you still hear about, you know, underground bases and this and that and the other. So I think in some sense that original idea has never left us. It's just the point of origin that's in question.
Yeah. It's just not going to, I don't think it's going to change. It's not going to change anytime soon.
No.
I interviewed, because of RPG, I interviewed Cassidy Nicholas, who's a, she's the media person for MUFON. I think the media relations person. And I, you know, I haven't posted the show yet, but my questions to her were just kind of like, you know, what's MUFON doing? Why are people doing some people doing such crazy things? What's the party line of MUFON? Do they care to hear anything else besides aliens are coming from other planets? And she said, of course we want to hear about that stuff. Send that proposal to the national whoever and see if he wants to, you know, run it in the journal. I was like, what? Really? Are you sure? Because I did tell her, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, longer than that, I gave a talk where I said, get rid of all large UFO organizations. They're useless.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't think they're useless. I think they're good at, I've changed a little bit. I think they're good as data gathering, but they should gather different data in addition to what they're doing. You know, how did it make you feel? What's your background? What's your blood type? History of mental illness in your family, history of chronic illness in your family. She said they asked questions like, what were you doing right beforehand? A little bit of what happened afterwards, normal things. But getting these really weird ones in there, I don't know how to pick them, but getting these really weird questions in there I think would help, because then you'd have a bigger database. You could start making weird comparisons, because if you make the normal comparisons, like, what sector of the sky did it come from, and what how much of the arc of the sky did it cover, and what was the speed and all that? Who cares?
Yeah,
really, because we've got way too much of that data already. But there ought to be ways to massage that data, like, you know, what happens on Wednesday night to people with Celtic blood, and if it's women, are they on their period or whatever? You know, it's just stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, too, it doesn't seem like so many of them come down from space. They're just in the sky.
Yeah.
You know, they just kind of start there. They're not, people don't necessarily see them going into outer space. They see them either fly across the sky or just disappear.
Or they just go up till they disappear very quickly, or away until they disappear very quickly. Usually people, you know, a lot of this, like one of those, not even close encounters, but a lot of sightings are just, as far as I know, are just like, I noticed something moving. And I watched it, and it started moving really crazy. Or, you know, it was moving really crazy, and then it came right to me. It's like, that's the other thing. It's like, you're out in the middle of nowhere, and the UFO comes right to you. There's got to be, like, you know, 10 or 12 other people around. Why did it come right to you?
Well, I think that also kind of talks to the aspect of consciousness being involved.
Yeah.
I wonder sometimes, though, about the efficacy of data gathering. I mean, not only is it hard to figure out what questions to ask, but it's so hard to, I mean, how many of those questions that you ask are going to be leading? How many of those questions are going to be answered by people who have a mental imbalance? How many people are going to be, you know, how many people are going to be answering something that, you know, garbage in, garbage out, you know?
Oh, we talked about that, didn't we, when you were on the show one time? We were just saying, like, why don't we just let people just talk?
Yeah. I mean, because that's the one thing in all these experiences that I keep on coming back to is the impression that it leaves upon the witness. I think it's more pronounced in UFO reports than it is in, you know, Sasquatch reports. And people just are like, oh, look, there's a Willy Booger, and they just see it run off into the forest. Or even, like, you know, little synchronicities that we always write off. But UFOs are something so genuinely anomalous that I think that people carry that experience with them in a much more profound way than a lot of other phenomena.
Yeah, it's true. It screws with you.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It kind of shakes up your whole everything.
Yeah, well, that's why I wrote that thing about UFOs being a cosmic art project.
Yes.
You know, in 2006 or 2007 or whatever. It's like, you know, that's the only thing I can think of that affects people in the way that UFOs do, where it's like the best piece of art you ever saw that just shakes you to the core and changes your worldview. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not it's not a concert, it's not music, it's not, you know, so it's not a book. It's something that's just like undeniably there that just takes your worldview and just goes whoop and completely screws with it for a while. And you yeah. know, that a really good piece of art does that too. That maybe not so permanently, well, sometimes it does. But I thought that'd be a, you know, kind of a fruitful way to look at it is, you know, what, how does it affect the your it's affecting your right and left brain at the same time and really putting it through the blender, you know.
And also that a good piece of art has the capacity to be interpreted and appreciated differently by different yes. people, right?
Yeah, that's another in the in an essay I wrote for the new book. I actually said that. I said, like, you know, it's going to be so much deeper. I use the example of Stanley Kubrick in 2001. He gave, mm-hmm. and David Lynch to some extent too, but I just said, okay, well, as an example, people saw 2001 and it just, like, you know, it blew them away. They're just like, blah, 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 what is this? You know, and some of them couldn't handle it and they didn't know. And there was an interview, I think, in Playboy, and they said, well, what the hell's going on in that movie? And he said, I don't really want to say what's going on in it because that, in so many words, he said, that takes away from the experience. He says, I think I know what I meant when I was doing it, but I'm not going to impose that on other people because then the artwork doesn't speak individually, which is where the strongest, you know, you get your strongest reaction when somebody connects with it personally in some way, even in ways, and especially in ways you didn't intend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, death of the author, you know.
Yeah,
the exactly. The idea that once you've created this thing, you kind of, in most examples, you should let it go, unless you're George Lucas.
Yeah, it's no and, longer yours.
And let it become its own thing and let it speak to people on its own terms.
Yeah, which is, yeah, that if you take that to a logical or illogical extreme, some kind of extreme, that's the UFO experience. Mm-hmm.
So it seems though that like it was people like John Keel and Jacques Vallée that kind of turned the whole, well, these are obviously Martians or aliens, a little bit on its head.
Yeah.
You know, and that was late 70s for both of them. They kind of approached it from a different way, or late 70s or late 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, very early on. When I was a crying little baby and when I was a little kid reading their books and being completely, you know, having my brain twisted every which a ways, they're already, you know, in their 30s or 40s and already past that stuff and on to other things. That's what kind of amazes me. And the other thing that amazes me, when people say things like that or they bring it up and they think it's original, it's like, this was original 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, when Jacques made that revelation that, hey, look, these fairy stories are the same thing.
Yeah.
And when Keel just, you know, was going, look, this doesn't make sense as aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we all obviously are big fans of Keel and Ballet. You know, they are like the heroes in our pantheon. But let us not forget the contribution of Jenny Randles, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely,
and especially because ufology, sadly, is still kind of a boys' club, you know, even in 2016. But you know, Jenny is probably one of the biggest contributors to this idea of trying to move away from the easy explanations of the UFO phenomenon.
Yeah, she's the one. Oz factor thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the Oz factor, I think, is a very important thing that she coined and recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I
mean, her last book, I think the last book she wrote was the Time Storms one.
Yeah.
Okay. The last one I read, I can't even remember what the last one I read was, but I definitely read the one where she introduced the concept of the Oz factor, which was an early one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Time Storms one, I mean, it was interesting. She was basically explaining UFOs as disruptions in time-space.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting, but I don't think it really fit, you know, enough of the phenomena to be a valid explanation. I mean, it could explain some of it.
Yeah. Nothing anybody says explains all of it. So that's why I'm really interested in what causes people to make the report. I'm not going to, I'm trying not to assume what that is, what the causative element is, but if you can look at the effects of it, maybe you can somehow laterally or something dig down to what the source of it might be, because we're, it's like dark matter. We don't see dark matter, but we see the effects of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if dark matter exists at all.
It's a name for something that has an effect on the matter we can see.
Okay.
You know?
All right.
So that's what I think is going on with the UFO thing. It has an effect on us, but we don't know what causes that. And if we can look at how we interpret and process all that weird input, maybe there's some way to tunnel our way back to what the cause of the source is, or at least get ourselves out of our own way to figure out what it is. Another thing I wrote was that, you know, maybe the phenomenon is something that holds a big mirror up to us every time we get too close.
Mm-hmm.
True. Mm-hmm. Well, when I had Ken Gerhardt on talking about his flying humanoids, you know, the cryptids and stuff.
Yeah.
And he's very, you know, when it comes to Bigfoot and stuff, he's very much thinking they're flesh and blood animals and so on. And he's collecting these cryptid stories. And I'm saying to him, well, you know, this doesn't really make sense as flesh and blood animals. Why are only one person seeing these things in so many cases?
Yeah.
You know, it's one person encounters it. It's never been reported again. So if the person's being honest, how does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. And I had suggested to him that maybe they're encountering something they simply can't understand. Like their brain has no ability to process the energy field they're encountering. Mm-hmm. So it has to put something there, and it might put, you know, a gibberish there. And that gibberish is a flying monster. And they go, oh, my God. And they take off and they report honestly that they saw this flying monster. But what they really encountered is something their brain had no frame of reference for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how did he answer that? It's like, did he say, well, what about videos and multiple witness sightings and stuff like that?
No, for this one, for the flying humanoids, he thought that was an interesting idea.
Oh, okay. But not for Bigfoot.
Not for Bigfoot, right.
See, because that's really weird to me where you would have that idea where you would, what's the word? You would put them in categories where, no, this is definitely flesh and blood. And my first thing about Bigfoot is, well, then why have we never found a dead one ever?
Yeah.
Ever, yeah. Ever, ever.
Because, Greg, they're really fast and they bury their,
they bury their dead in very remote places. And someday we're going to find a cache. It'll be like an elephant's graveyard. There'll be 8,000 dead Bigfoots in a cave.
No, the,
well, you know, the thing, I asked Lyle Blackburn that because he's also a believer in the flesh and blood Bigfoot. And, you know, he just very honestly said, I can't answer that. I don't know.
Mm. Well, in all honesty, what you'll often hear researchers and hunters say is that, you know, well, there are probably more black bear than there are Bigfoot. And there certainly people certainly don't run across dead black bear in the forest very often. And I'm like, yeah, but they have.
It has happened
at some point.
And there's so many much more people out in the wilderness now just poking around and hunting and all that. You know, it's like somebody somewhere should have found something. Well, yeah. What happens is the government comes through and sweeps it up right afterwards. So.
And honestly, like sometimes the governmental Bigfoot collection resonates with me a little bit more strongly than the crash spaceship collection of debris, simply because of, you know, the economic angle, I think, is in some ways a lot more present in terms of what the implications would be if it, you know, I think about the issues that we face as a nation today and the sort of kettle of worms that would be opened up by the idea that logging land or national park land actually belongs to a, you know, third stream of indigenous yeah. people, and possibly, and what the, you know, what that would open up. So sometimes that explanation does resonate with me, but I still think that it's not, you know, government can't be everywhere all the time to pick up dead Bigfoot as they drop dead.
No, I was making a joke. No, I really don't think it's a flesh and blood.
But some people have said that. Some people have said that the government comes through and tidies up Bigfoot bodies.
Well, since you brought the government up, so when we look at the 1980s, after guys, or not 1970s, they seem to be a decade ahead every time I open my mouth. When Vallée and Keel came up with these ideas, when you go into the 1970s is when you and 80s is when you see stuff like government documents coming out and stuff like that. So it makes me wonder if maybe they're doing this to intentionally push things down the extraterrestrial path.
I wouldn't.
You know, is it better for the government to have people think there are extraterrestrials out there and they just deny it? Or, you know, is it better for the government for people to have more of an open view of this stuff?
Well, my thing, which I've been pushing for years, is I think the government knows what's going on, or parts of it do, but they're just, you know, it's that, what's that old Kiel thing, that the UFO research community is not telling the government what it knows about UFOs. I think they probably know more than us about what's going on and what might be happening, but there's no way to control it, explain it, or at least explain it in a way that anybody would understand without freaking out. So why deal with the subject as long as people just, you know, most people in responsible positions sweep it under the rug, don't really worry about it. It's not really a daily thing that anybody really has to worry about. So why deal with it? But yeah, if you can use it to mess with people and cover up projects and people away from things and find out what spy rings are doing, who's talking to who, and where the UFO information goes and all that. Yeah, sure. Why not? I don't know where that leaves people in the government that come forward and say that they've seen aliens and dead ones and all that. I don't know what to make of that. See, that's where my theory falls apart. Either they're lying, which I don't think they all are, or they've been made to think this, which is a possibility, or there really is some weird non-human thing that the government knows about. And I don't know, you know, since there's no way to prove any of those things, I really don't know what to say about it, except that, you know, to go back to my original thing, it's like, I think they do, all the way from total BS to the spectrum, all the way up to they have dead aliens and all that. I think that my opinion will hold, meaning, yeah, we know it's happening. No, we don't know why, how to control it, or how to explain it to people. So let's sweep it under the rug for now and use it when we can.
And then they may not know any more what it is than we do.
Right. Yeah. That's my point. I think they know, probably some people in the government or in some positions of power know more about the, like what we would call like spectacular cases or whatever, physical evidence or whatever. But I don't think they know, like you said, much more than we do about where it comes from, what causes it, and more importantly, how to control it. There's no way to control when and where and how it's going to appear to people.
Or something that I've considered in the past is maybe the government knows a great deal about one aspect that really did quote-unquote happen. So like, let's theoretically say that Roswell did happen and it was a crash, but it's the only thing that has ever really happened that they've gotten their hands on, and everything else is part of this weird high strangeness that doesn't fit in with that phenomena at all. It reminds me of someone one time saying, wouldn't it be interesting if we did finally make contact with an extraterrestrial civilization and they land and we're like, oh, we've been seeing your lights in the sky all this time and they've been doing these weird stuff with our consciousness, and they go, oh yeah, we had that happen to us too, we thought you'd know what it was. You know, sometimes I wonder if there isn't some sort of hybrid answer, you know, that sort of can account for that.
Yeah, yeah. Some sort of interaction, because, you know, my current thing is the interaction is the 90% or more that we bring to it, saying this has got to be what it is, even if it's something totally insane. But that's not what it is, because we can't comprehend what it is. So we have to shove our metaphors on it.
Right,
right.
Yeah, it reminds me of that one of my favorite X-Files episodes, in which Fox Mulder kind of switches bodies with a man in black working on Area 51. Huh. And in the end, you know, Mulder ends up talking with the colonel in charge of the Area 51 base, and the colonel asks him, do aliens exist? You know, and this is after, you know, the colonel admitting that they fly all these super secret man-made UFO craft, you know, that they keep on Area 51 and all that. But even he, who was in control of that program, didn't know really where did the government come up with that technology, you know. So that's the idea that there are probably more people scratching their heads inside the government or wanting to know more about beyond their need to know basis than people in the public segment. And it's now, take for example, this guy, what's the name of this guy? Alexander, right?
John Alexander, yeah.
John Alexander, yeah. I mean, he was in charge of this group of people in the military who wanted to know, you know, and
I don't know if he was in charge. Are you talking about the aviary?
Not the aviary, the group that...
the theoretical physics working group thing?
Yeah, yeah, that one.
Yeah, I think that came after the aviary with some of the same people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just insiders that like are really interested in the subject, but... And they think, oh, well, we're in the government. The government knows about it. We should be able to, you know, poll people that we know that should know that and tell us what the government knows, and then maybe we'll have an answer. None of them were ever able to find anything, as far as I know. I mean, even Hal Puthoff was still asking Bill Moore questions about certain things years later, like up into about 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, I think. Hmm. So I don't think they ever found out. I mean, they got closer than anybody else, but they really didn't find out much more. Well, it's like, yes, you know, yes, there was a crash at Roswell of something or whatever. I don't know if they found that out. But the thing is, like, but we don't know what it was, and we don't have any real proof that you know, you can't see the proof if there is any. It's like, well, that where does that leave? It doesn't leave you any better off than you and I and all of us talking and listening here.
Okay, yeah. So who do you guys think in the government really knows a hell lot about the UFO secrets?
No idea.
Yeah, I think it would be a black project somewhere.
My take would be Henry Kissinger.
Why?
He's been involved with several administrations, you know. He was very close to Richard Nixon, and I think there's a lot of speculation that during the Nixon administration, the UFO secret was transferred to the private sector.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think that, and also Kissinger is involved with all these Bilderberg groups. You know, he's been to Bohemian Grove. He probably has, you know, his own room in that place.
Yeah.
So my take would be, you know, he could be one of the people who knows.
I guess he could be one.
More.
Yeah. I tend to think that anybody that would know the most about it, you would have never heard of him.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Maybe Harry Rosicky Falcon knew something about it, but I don't think so.
You want to talk about that here for this episode?
Which?
You know, about the how you managed to learn the name of Falcon, this guy.
I'll make it short. What happened is I asked Bill Moore after writing Project Beta, and he would not tell me. And then at the end, I think he had died like in 2001 before I even started writing the book. So it was probably okay for him to tell me. But he did the old, you know, if you guess it, I'll tell you. So what I did for 2 years is threw guesses at him. There used to be a thing online called Namebase, I think, and it was basically... What it was a bunch of researchers who were interested in the intelligence community had listed all these people that had been, you know, known CIA, NSA, Naval Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, all these people who knew who, when they knew each other, what they knew about, what they'd written about. And they had these, you could call up somebody's name, and it would give you a little chart showing you all these lines about who knew each other. Like there'd be all these, you know, one nexus would be George Bush Sr. They're like, you know, 500 lines coming out of him to everybody. Then you'd have a weird outlier like what's his name? Stuart Copeland's father, Miles Copeland, I think, because his brother's is Miles too, but I think his father was Miles Copeland, who was in a high rank in the CIA. That's why he grew up like all over the world, because he kept getting stationed different places. That's how Stuart Copeland, you know, learned all the weird drumming things and all that, because he got exposed to all these different cultures. But anyway, I looked through there and I just started throwing names at him based on, you know, who I thought he knew. And then he gave me clues, like, you know, he was in the OSS. He was an expert on Russian stuff, obviously. So I concentrated on people that were Soviet experts and all, and there were a lot of them. Anyway, so everything I threw at him, he said no. So one day we went hiking out in the middle of nowhere. And he says, "You've been guessing for 2 years, so I'm just going to tell you." So he told me, and I said, "I know that name. He's on the list of people I was looking at that I didn't think was likely." So I had the name. It's just that I didn't, you know, I hadn't thrown it at him because I didn't think it was very important. Mm. So, and then I announced that basically. In fact, I actually called him beforehand. I said, "I'm going to put this out in the public. Do you care?" And he said, "Nope, don't care at all. Go right ahead." So I did, and I really haven't heard word one from anybody since then, except for most people just accepted it. And because I wanted to find out if somebody would come out of the woodwork and just say, "Yeah, well, you got it right, and I know for a fact," and all that. And you know, do a little bit more research on him because I was on to other things at that point. I've done that many times where I've thrown out little pieces of information here and there. I did it in Project Beta. I threw weird little things in just to see if anybody would react and say, "Oh, I know about that," and never. So either the people that know don't want to talk to me or they just haven't read it.
Well, yeah.
But I can't even remember all the little hints and clues I put in there. Probably, you know, I would mention something offhandedly in a chapter just to see if somebody would say something about it, and nobody ever did. All people concentrated on was, you know, how horrible Bill Moore was and what a monster Richard Doty was and all that, which, you know, I don't totally disagree, but, you know, there were things going on in that book that that were very selfish for me, you know, besides trying to tell the story. I just thought, I can throw this little piece, this little Easter egg in here and see if anybody says anything. And nobody ever really did. I think Bill Moore did a couple times. He goes, "Hey, I saw you put that thing in there." I was like, "Yeah, I'm putting out some honey to see if anybody comes."
But would they? That's the thing. Like, even if they noticed it, are they necessarily going to say anything?
No, they don't have to. I mean, but the thing is that what it was if you the bait is if you know something or possibly can like make a connection for them, for somebody that's in that world or knows about it real well, they will come to you because that, you know, what they're doing is like this. It's a giant chess game that goes on for years for most of your life, and you know, if you can get an advantage by getting information, then you're ahead of the game, or at least you feel a little bit better about like answering questions for yourself. When I was doing the book, people would tell me stuff, and sometimes they would directly say, "Are you going to talk to so and so?" I go, "Yeah." They say, "Mention this name and see what happens." And I would do stuff like that, and some of the time they'd say, "I don't know what you're talking about," and sometimes they'd go, "Oh, really?" And a little bit more information would come tumbling out that would help me, and then they'd say something that made no sense to me whatsoever, and I'd go back to the other person. Because I was a go-between. This is what Bill Moore did for a while, too, and sort of in the same way. It's just that I really, you know, I didn't have to do anything for them except pass information back and forth if I could. And it didn't happen a lot, but it was very interesting when it did.
Well, I was about to say, that's got to be an intelligence tactic, you know, in terms of military intelligence. I'm sure that sort of thing happens all the time, just like seeding information to see if anybody steps up.
Yeah, but these people, I think the majority of them were retired, and there may be other things going on that where I was used for I don't know what reason. But the main thing was that I could see going on was I didn't have access to this information. This person did. If you can get that piece of information from them and give them this one, it was like paying. The information was like currency.
Mm-hmm.
If you can give me this, if I can give them this little piece of information, and they can give me back this other little piece of information that I always wanted to know, but nobody would tell me. But now that I'm retired, I'd like to find this out. It's like, who was doing that thing to me years ago, or who was involved in that operation, where stuff that I had no idea, absolutely no idea what they were talking about. But, you know, the thing I said about listening really carefully and remembering everything, because none of them would let me record anything. But listening, and you know, this is amounted to like five or six people, probably only probably three of them, which made it into the book. But it was present, and I knew it was happening, and a couple people told me it was happening. So I, you know, it wasn't frightening. It was exciting. It didn't frighten me at all, because it's like, well, so what if somebody's watching me, or nobody said anything to me? I haven't been threatened. I don't notice anybody spying on me, so why should I care?
What would you say was the most interesting thing you learned that way?
I'm trying to think. I was not told anything directly, but it was one of those, if I guessed it, I was told that I was right. And one of them was the laser stuff, that it was hinted, the laser Starfire range thing. I don't know if I'm remembering this right, but people told me certain bits and pieces of it. Like one guy I interviewed, he goes, you know, have you ever heard of Bob Fugate? And I was like, huh, who? He goes, oh, well, he worked at the Starfire range, and I think he's still there. So I looked him up online, and then I also asked him other people. I went to Palomar Observatory one time, and there was a guy telling us about, what's that called? Atmospheric, the thing where you can take software and compensate for the atmosphere bending light and messing up your adaptive optics. I went to Palomar Observatory, and there was an astronomer there, and somehow, because of where I was or whatever, he was giving a little tour, and when it was over, he walked me out of the observatory in a different, through like all these rooms where they don't take tourists. He showed me the adaptive optics room. It was just a big computer room, because I mentioned that I knew about it, and then I mentioned I couldn't think of Bob Fugate's name. And it was funny because he was talking to me very interestingly. He was very interested and excited about what I was saying until I couldn't remember Robert Fugate's name. And he left me abruptly at that point, like almost rudely. It was very weird. Huh. And he's an astronomer working for Palomar Observatory. You know, what the hell does he know about secret things and all that? But I said, oh yeah, I know about that. I know how that was developed. I know it was developed as a defense thing to look at satellites. And he's like, okay, he knows what he's talking about. So he pulled me aside and talked to me for a little bit.
Hmm. Huh.
But yeah, that wasn't like a direct thing. I just kind of had to infer it. And once I inferred it, then more information came tumbling out, because people are like, okay, well, you figured it out. So, you know, but it was inferred very heavily. I mean, an idiot would have had to. would have noticed.
I think so that one of the
and some of it's not.
I think one of the things that impacted me the most personally when I read Project Beta was this thing about JL and Hynek.
Yeah.
Giving Benowitz this computer that was, you know, programmed by the Air Force. Intended, yep, to keep them, you keep him thinking that he was like talking to aliens and deciphering their language and whatnot. You know, I think that because nowadays we have this kind of like idealized image of Hynek. You know, like, I mean, it's one of the same patrons of ufology right now, right?
Huh. And I still think he is. I don't care about that story.
Well, you know, which is in sharp contrast with how they thought of him,
yeah,
back in the 50s and 60s, you know, I mean,
yeah.
Coran Lorenzen, I think, always despised him. I saw him as someone, you know, like a bad guy that has switched his black hat for a white hat for some reason, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't. Go ahead.
No.
All right. I made a point. We can talk about other things. I made a point in the book of saying Bill Moore is the one who told me this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important. So in contrast to the rest of the things in the book, or most of them, if only one person told me something, I would very specifically, like, you know, Richard Doty said he worked at Area 51. It's like, that's in the chapter where he told me he said that. I didn't say that other people had, you know, corroborated it. But Bill is the only one that told me that, and I actually tried to get records, find out from the Center for UFO Studies if there was anything on Benowitz or anything to do with that period, and I don't think they were covering it up. They just thought I was another crazy person thinking they were writing a book, so they never really looked for the records for me or responded to me that much. But that's another, it's like I put it in there, one, because I thought it was really important if true, and two, if I put it in there, maybe somebody could prove or disprove it in some way. Nobody's ever come forward to do that. Nobody's actually, most people haven't even said anything. It's like, how could he do such a thing? They don't even mention it. I was surprised when I heard it. I said, wow, what a Hynek? Are you kidding me? You know, but he said Hynek had told him that. It's like, and the thing is like, oh, Bill Moore's a liar. It's like, people that are close to you and that you trust, you treat differently. I think he treats me differently. I would hope he does.
Have any of you read Forbidden Science from Jacques Vallée, his first volume?
I haven't, and I never really... It's his diaries, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I've read bits and pieces of it.
There is, and I'm trying to, it's been a few years since I've read it, but there was something in there about Hynek not acknowledging certain information that Jacques got very upset about. Like he found it kind of hidden.
Oh, really?
in his room or something. And he was like, why is this here and not being presented, you know? And I think he started feeling like he was betraying the whole research and just going along with whatever he was told to do.
Ah.
And there were numerous times where Jacques says, you know, he got very frustrated with Hynek because Hynek was following their lead. And he's like, why are you doing this? He's like, because I don't want them to cut me off from the information.
Ah, you see, I'd heard that he had been on the payroll for quite a few years after, just basically as, you know, a retainer saying, hey, if we need you for something. And one of those things might have been delivering that computer program. And when you say this, it sounds like, you know... not just information, but maybe some sort of stipend he was getting. It might not be a big one, but you know, considering what his economic situation was, which I don't know if it was great, every little bit would help.
So yeah. Once a G-man, always a G-man.
Maybe it doesn't make me think any less of him. I mean, God, he unless he's out there like setting kittens on fire. Or, molesting kids or something. I don't think it affects the work that he did. It's kind of like who was that guy that got said he was going to MIT and then some people, I think Lance Moody, I think, found out that he never had any degree.
Phil Imbrogno?
Yeah. Everybody said, well, big fat liar, and he said it's worthless now. It's like, no, it's not. The thinking process was still there. I mean, I like the way he thought about things. He was in that same sort of, if you go down that Vallée, Kiel, Greg Little, Michael Grosso, whatever kind of, no, I'm not really Michael Grosso. He's not really a UFO person. But if you go down that non-ETH path, I think he was very heavily pushing that in intelligent ways. Whether people said the same thing about Kiel. He made stuff up. Like, I don't care if he made stuff up. The ideas were great.
Yeah, but see, my thing is that with the Imbrogno story, I mean, it's already difficult enough in this particular field to decipher people's allegiances.
Yeah.
And you want somebody to, you know, it's the old fool me once, shame on me sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Twice,
shame on you. Or, sorry, I had that backwards.
Yes, George Bush.
Womp, womp. I feel like this is something that's a fear that I live with, is I'm going to misspeak about something and it's going to be like, he's lying about it. But, you know, I feel like that's a pretty big thing to fabricate, you know, your academic credentials in this case.
Yeah. I agree, but it doesn't make me think I'm not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I just can't. I don't know if I trust any of his stories, but the theorizing doesn't involve making up stories. It's just like, well, look at it in this way, based on these BS stories that I've made up, but look at it in this way.
Yeah, and that's the frustrating thing for me, is because I've run across some great stories of his that I'd like to use in my research, and I'm like, oh, great, who did this come from? Damn it, came from Improgno.
I want to get back to Hynek and this idea that he probably was a retainer to the Air Force after he left Blue Book. Do you think the same thing could also apply to someone like Nick Pope?
Never thought of it, but maybe. It's a different thing. But the thing is, like, what I don't know how much Nick Pope is affecting the way people think about things, really.
Well, Peter Robbins will say.
It's no knock on Nick
Pope. Peter Robbins will say that he is.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you I guess you could say that, especially when somebody's saying something you don't like. You know, I but I don't know about Nick Pope. I mean, I'm putting my own thing on it because most people, you know, what he says is, to me, it doesn't interest me personally. Okay. So, you know, so I guess I don't have a valid opinion on it. So we'll shut up.
Well, let me ask you this. You mentioned Keel making stuff up. Has anyone ever presented evidence that Keel made any of this stuff up?
Carla Turner, when I interviewed her, told me that she said she liked Keel, but he made stuff up. I said, like what? And she said something about Asbury Park having to do with some place that Bruce Springsteen had done something, and she said that Keel was talking about that same place, or she knew for a fact that something he said about a place that she had lived was wrong. So that's why she said that he was making stuff up.
But was he making stuff up, or was he just wrong about something? I mean, we've all misspoke and miscredited
who knows?
Things.
I do not know. I also, you know, when Alan Greenfield was on my show recently, he said that Keel was one of the more paranoid people he'd ever met, and that they could scare him really easily by, you know, calling and making funny noises on the phone, which is what Mosley and Harper did just to mess with him, because they just wanted to tease him. So I don't know. You know, she had told me that he made stuff up, and then somebody like Alan Greenfield and to some extent Mosley when he was alive told me that he was a credulous person, and that he was, you know, he would make leaps of logic on things that weren't necessarily robust or true or whatever. Right. So it's like, you know, it still doesn't bother me because I like his thought process, and I like what he's trying to make people, I like the ideas he puts forth because they made sense and they weren't ETH ideas.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a bias of mine. I know it is. Anytime somebody's anti-ETH, suddenly I'm like, what, really?
You're Pavlovian.
Yes, exactly. I start salivating when I hear somebody say, yeah, stupid alien. The beginning of my show right now is basically three people saying the same thing. It's Keel saying something like the extraterrestrial thing is not well supported. Then Jacques Vallée saying we don't know where these things are coming from. We can say they come from other planets. We don't know for sure. And then Mac Tony saying that they come from a domain of pure information. Probably.
Right.
You know, to me, that's like a holy trinity of let's look at other stuff. I don't hate ETH. Yeah. I just kind of like, I'm so bored with it, and it's proven nothing.
And when I first started getting into UFO stuff, I mean, the ETH thing made sense when you were very limited on data, when you only had certain books to read. It's like, oh, you know, you read Missing Time, and you're thinking, wow, he really has a solid case here. And then you start reading Keel and Vallée, and it's like, wow, okay, maybe it's not as a solid. But you know what did it for me, I think, was Kenneth Ring.
Oh, yeah, that's another one, yeah.
When he did the comparison of after effects of near-death experiences and UFO abductions and found them to be very similar, it's like, okay, how does this make sense if it's aliens?
Yeah, same you thing know, with the DMT, with Rick Strassman's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, something we were talking
it's about. Not the exact, but it's very similar. So what's going on? You know, if this can be made up out of whole cloth, basically, then... Yeah, you know, what's going on? I'm not saying those people are making it up, but I'm saying it's tickling the same parts of their brains.
Right, right.
Yeah, and something we were talking about before we talked to you, Greg, is how it's almost gotten to the point where whenever I'm listening to something and they're just harping on the ETH, I just automatically don't find it as interesting as more some of these more esoteric reality bending concepts. Because for me, if you accept the ETH as an answer right now, it kind of takes away some of the mystery that drew me to the subject in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, that's going on. Yeah, you hit it. I mean, I don't like to admit that because it sounds very, you know, what's the word, reactionary, but it's just the way I am. I will admit to it. It's like, you know, it makes things more interesting for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You get to push into different areas. It's like, what star system do they come from? Or, you know, all that. I'm not interested in that. What do they want? Why do they want our genetic material? It's like, I'm not interested in that in the least. Because that's a wrong goddamn question.
Right.
To me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that Radio Mysterioso show that when you had the late Bruce Duensing, he had so many things that he was so spot on. One of them being that how ufology as a field has not really kept up with the latest scientific developments. I mean, they're still stuck with this like 1960s, 1970s version of science that is really not in pair with what we have been discovering about, I don't know, not only consciousness, but quantum mechanics, perception, which was, I think, one of his main interests.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's, if ufology is to ever move forward from these boring concepts that we've been, you know, pining up during this show, they really need to have someone in their organization that is willing to take a look at all these new developments and try to incorporate them into their, I don't know, corpus or their manuals or their, you know, their training.
Or at least support it in some way. You know, when I had James Carrion on when he was head of MUFON, he actually told me there was some MUFON group in the Northeast that was doing supposedly DMT research. And I said, huh? What? MUFON? He goes, yeah, I'm pretty sure they are. I don't know if we're sponsoring them, but they're part of MUFON. They're just doing their own thing. And I was like, oh, wow, maybe I'll join up again. But that gave me real hope. And then, you know, talking to Cassidy Nicholas the other day, I'm still kind of guarded in my, it's like, really? Do they really care about this stuff? Because, you know, the public face of is ETH and, you know, doing, and she also told me she basically really didn't like the way the TV show was done, Hangar One. She said a lot of people in MUFON hated Hangar One. Like, I didn't know that. I thought, you know, you think of them as a big, you know, monolithic entity where everybody does the same thing. You know, what if you could do something, a maverick thing, and be able to affect, you know, people's thought in that way? It's like, maybe. I think I might submit them a paper.
I'm telling you, Greg.
Something I even considered, you know, a couple years ago.
I'm telling you, Greg, If I hadn't experienced some of that positivity firsthand myself, I would be skeptical too. But I really get the impression after having met some of the people in the Georgia chapter that they're totally open to this. I mean, this is Georgia, so
yeah. Well, what have they said?
I mean, just that they are if they feel like someone is going out into the field with a strong conviction to prove the ETH as part of the case, they will pull them.
Yeah.
Everyone that I talked to in the upper management was intimately familiar with the work of Dean Radin, was intimately familiar with the work of other parapsychological individuals. The conversations that we had drifted towards questions of perception. And I had people at the upper levels of the chapter literally say to me, I don't know what's going on, but little green scientists don't answer all of our questions.
Yeah. Nice.
Which I found it was an extremely heartening experience for me.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm behind now. Not that
they yes. took your advice and now you have nothing to whinge about.
Yeah, well, it's not my advice. I think it's just generally people are coming up that are younger and they're kind of tired of the same thing. It's like, what are we going to do? Are we going to find an answer? Or are we just going to just keep spinning our wheels and have a circle jerk here about the ETH? I think they're totally tired of that. And that's good. I mean, I don't trust organizations generally. I don't trust large organizations. But the thing is, if it's not as rigid as I think it is, then, you know, maybe my not vitriol, but my
disdain.
You know, I guess disdain, whatever, is misplaced. It's based on what you and Cassidy Nicholas said, and it frightens me in a good way.
Well, and I think too, when you see someone like Mike Cleland having such an effect on the culture,
yeah.
That's a really good sign.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because he's not promoting one idea over another. He's just presenting the data in a very open way, and people are flocking to it. People really like what he has to say.
Yeah. And that's good, because I like Mike because he's non-dogmatic. I mean, you can tell him, you know what, you're full of crap. And he's just kind of like, well, maybe I am, but this is interesting stuff I found out.
Well, that's why when I did our UFO history series, I put him and Aaron Gullius together.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. Aaron's so grounded, so historical, and Mike is so open and isn't afraid to go into like the consciousness aspects.
Yeah.
And together they made, you know, they made such a great pair looking at the history of UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a bunch of podcasts doing great stuff now. Scary. I'm going to be left behind pretty soon here. And that will be a good thing. Because then I can, instead of whining, I can start going, my God, you found that out? I feel like such an idiot. Tell me more, you know?
Well, let me ask you this, Greg. What researchers do you see today, other than like Mike Cleland, who are doing a good job with this?
Yeah, Micah. Very early on, I thought Micah Hanks was. Basically, he's not dog. Anybody that's not really dogmatic. And then you know, outliers like Strassman. That don't even really have any idea, you know, don't even care about the subject, then they suddenly get pulled into it. God, I'm trying to think. I'd have to go on my list of people that have been on my show. You know, Alan Greenfield is. I'm like totally on his wavelength, and he's not a new person. He's 68 or 69 or something.
Yeah, I think he said he was 69.
Yeah. Who else? Let's see. Yeah, well, poor Bruce died, unfortunately, with a heart problem. He was like a very recent, very strong hero of mine for the way he was thinking about it. And people weren't really listening to him because he's obtuse for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, you really have to listen to what he's saying and really get involved with it to read it to understand what's going on. You almost have to infer what he's saying rather than look at it literally. One of our, you know, actually two people on the show with me right now, who I know very well, Joshua and RPJ, they're just like, you know, continually coming up with ideas that make me go, yeah, right. Holy shit, that's so good.
I disagree. I've never had one single original idea about this. You know?
I think you have, but whatever. Well, maybe you just make me happy by listening to me. And well, the thing is, when I talk to you or Joshua and a few other people I know, you know, at that point, that person becomes my personal hero because we get each other going.
Mm. It's all about creating a loop of energy. Yeah, it's almost like reading a room as a performer or something.
Yeah, exactly. Aaron's good. You just mentioned him.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I'd throw in Walter, although I don't think that he is focusing on UFOs as much nowadays.
Walter
Bosley.
Yeah, I'd throw him in there. Well, that's just a few of them. But yeah, it's funny. It seems like when I think of it, most of the people, it's like, who's doing good work? It's like people I can talk to in an intimate way about it, like we're doing right now. Because it makes you go, yeah, yeah. And then you run back and you if you're writing, you pound something out, or you say, I really got to talk to that person. You know, who's that John Fenderson I had on? That's basically he's a technician, but he was into a bit of Western occultism and magic, and that to me, you know, along with what Alan Greenfield said, it's a very important part of the equation that people don't really want to look at because it's not scientific, you know.
Which is what?
The occult angle, which is basically that it is more involved with the person being involved with the subject and having some say in what they call to themselves and what they how they regard it and how they conduct themselves when faced with the information or whatever you want to call it. You know, like if somebody calls up some kind of weird entity and then they have to deal with it and all that. I see a lot of parallels between that and the UFO close encounter experience.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in a more controlled way. Oh, and the other one is the guy that used to be on that I met on the Paracast forums, the guy that's called Burnt State. He's really got my brain going in a lot of different directions. And I'll send him something I wrote, and he'll send me something that's longer than what I wrote, telling me what he thinks of what I wrote.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm. and when you bring up the occult stuff, I mean, that's kind of where I started. You know, before I ever saw a UFO, I had, you know, so much experience with entities and stuff doing occult, you know, rituals and things like that. And at one point it occurred to me that I think I was reading something of Strieber's, and it suddenly occurred to me that I'm having similar experiences with a completely different archetype over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, I never thought of what I was doing could have any connection to UFOs until that moment. And suddenly I'm like, wow, if I take this out of context, these experiences are very similar.
Mm-hmm. In what way? To carry that further?
Just the interactions, the stuff that was happening to me. It's just, it's like it put a different mask on.
Mm-hmm.
And after I made this realization is when I started actually experiencing UFOs.
Yeah, because it's because your brain, I think don't get mad at me, but I think your brain just jumped on the UFO rail.
Right, right, exactly. It suddenly opened that possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just looking at my site here. I had a guy on that has a website. I can't remember the name of the website, but what the name is Aaron Daba. He has a site. I think it's called Esoterics with an X.
The title of the writer was
If monsters don't exist, why are they out to get me?
Yeah, that's a great blog.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, there's another one. I mean, he's not specifically he's more of a Freudian than a UFO person. In fact, he's basically just an anomalist. But there's so much going on there and what he talks about and the way that you deal with weird information and how there's a lot to be said. I mean, there's a lot going on there that says a lot about the UFO experience too. And I'm sorry I'm not more specific, but I think you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't know that we'll ever figure out exactly what's going on with the UFO experience, but I think it is a central part of our existence. Even though, you know, it seems to be on an outlying thing, I think there are keys there to understanding who we are and what reality is.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, how malleable that might be, because you know, the way we look at things is not going to be the way an Aboriginal guy in Australia does, or and if you carry that, you know, if you keep carrying that out to all living things, too. I mean, I read an article the other day about, you know, if something is made out of matter, then it has a consciousness. And this is something that's being said by, you know, holy people and Buddhists, and Alan Watts lectured on it and all this. And this was an essay by a scientist the other day that I read. That blew me away.
That's horrifying to me.
Why?
If something has matter, it has a consciousness, right?
Well, you thinking consciousness in a way that we think of it as a human-centered one, but
right,
fair enough.
I'll give you the example that hooked it for me when I read that article. Is one of the Alan Watts lectures I have. He said he picks up a rock and he hits it against another rock, and he said that's a very primitive form of consciousness. It just made a noise. And if you're not literal about it, that makes sense.
Yeah, that does click. I was thinking more along the lines of every old cell phone that I've ever abused coming back to haunt me in the afterlife or something.
Well, I think consciousness is inextricably connected with matter. I don't think we would have this reality without consciousness.
Is it there's like the force, man? I'm not totally joking.
Because, I mean, you could say that maybe your individual cells all have some rudimentary form of consciousness, mm-hmm. you know, which shows them what to do.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading this article last year about this very famous Japanese designer. The guy, among other things, he designed the Kikkoman soy sauce bottle. Right? So this guy, check this out.
He used one the other day. Good.
Before he became a famous designer, he was a Zen monk.
Mm.
And he was present in, I think it was in Nagasaki, just when after the bomb dropped. And according to him, he remembered seeing all these objects that had been like destroyed by the bomb, and in his mind he saw all these objects, I don't know, chairs and I don't know, trains or whatever, wailing and crying, you know, over the fact that they had, you know, been devoid of their purpose, you know, and you know, as a designer, which is, you know, my main trade, you know, I find that interesting how we feel intent into the objects we design, the objects we use, you know, maybe that's one of the ways in which matter gains consciousness.
Is that, yeah, it needs us around to, it needs us around to be God.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Could be.
But we're just individual locus points. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the Hindu idea of like the net, and we're all little nodes in the net, but the net goes on forever and includes everything.
Right. I think also that you have, when I was talking about the cells, I think, you know, so each portion of you has its own sort of sense of consciousness, although completely different from what we experience, mm-hmm. and then it builds up to us, and then us as a community of you know, groups of humans also have a sense of consciousness, and then, you know, it just kind of keeps building out from there. Each organized system has some level of consciousness involved to it.
Yeah, either that or the organized system is the culmination of that form of consciousness.
Right.
Like, you know, the Alan Watts thing again, he's like, you know, maybe all of this is inherent in matter. Because what does he say? Even the South Park guys actually animated this little talk he gave. About 3 minutes of it. And he said, well, think of it this way. A bunch of aliens come to, you know, to Earth, 3 billion years ago. And they say, well, it's just a bunch of rocks. And they leave. And so then they come back, you know, like 3 billion years later. And the rocks are moving around but because they've turned into animals and things. And he said, maybe that's, you know, that's inherent if in the right conditions, maybe that's inherent in every type, in all matter, that organizing principle is there. It just needs the right conditions for it to organize itself into, you know, Britney Spears.
that was the principle that I was trying to sell to Alex Akiris during our little round table on Skeptical at the movies. We were discussing the movie Ex Machina, and I was trying to sell to Alex the idea that maybe, you know, if we could develop some kind of artificial brain that was just as complex and highly networked as a human brain, maybe it would be enough in order for that brain to not grow consciousness, but maybe, you know, tune in into this net or sea of consciousness that we've been discussing.
Well, you know, here's the other thing. I don't think we'll create artificial intelligence until we can create something that can essentially think in a novel way. Like, if it's just running through programming, is it really conscious? But if it's able to jump ahead of that programming and be something more than that programming, then you have to assume there's some level of consciousness.
We already have that.
Yeah, exactly. We already have
very rudimentary types of programs that rewrite themselves based on the conditions that it, the software rewrites itself based on the conditions it encounters.
But is it programmed to do that?
It is programmed to do it, but I'm reading a book called, I think it's called Our Last Invention, and it's basically a big thing saying, if we don't take control of artificial intelligence, it's going to kill us. I don't know if I totally believe that. I guess there's people like Elon Musk and what's his name? The smartest man in the world.
Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, Hawking, who are saying that. But the point in the book was that some of the software is so sophisticated that it rewrites itself, and the original programmers can't figure out how it rewrote itself. It's like, well, I don't even know how it did that, but it's changed itself into a form that it wasn't before, and I didn't tell it to do that, and I didn't encode that thing in it. I encoded, you know, certain things in it. It somehow figured out this stuff on its own and became a different program that is not the program I wrote.
I think the name for it is genetic algorithm.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And see, at that point, I would argue that might be actual consciousness intervening.
Yes, it might be. But, you know, what's the argument there? Did the guy put the consciousness in there by giving it its own thinking process or what?
Well, it had enough of a system to create a ghost in the machine.
I think what you're fostering is the propensity for more complexity in your system. And if you achieve that, then inevitably, as Greg said, you know, the rocks will grow a consciousness.
Right.
Yeah. If the software is there, eventually it becomes your robot overlord.
Well, you know, this sort of sorry, go ahead. Somebody was going to say something. Somebody?
Nope.
No.
Oh, okay.
Nope.
This sort of ties back around into this idea of art and its relationship as well, because I mean, I think that in some sense, works of art, once the creator steps away, do take on a personality of themselves, and they mean things to different people, and they can be interpreted in different ways. So I think, I mean, maybe it's just something about the act of complexity, yes, but the act of creating something that helps to allow consciousness in some sense, even rudimentary sense, into the system.
And the other thing is, we can't even really define what consciousness is. I mean, we can say in ourselves it's self-awareness, but I don't think self-awareness really defines consciousness.
Yes. I think that's a fair statement.
So at that point, you have to say, what is consciousness?
Yeah, that's a human-centered way of saying it, I think. It's aware of itself. I don't know about that. I don't know what it is either. I mean, I think it becomes obvious that something is conscious upon, it's almost a quantum physics thing, upon observing it, I guess. Mm. You know, I don't know, maybe there's rocks moving around on the other side of the universe somewhere and we don't know about it, but
or collections of gases.
Yeah. I don't know, because the thing is, we're so imbued with the way we look at things, it's hard to look at things from any other perspective. But, you know, if you're a really smart person, which I'm not, you would have to think that anything that's even in some way self-organizing, a rock is self-organizing, it's a rock. It may be possessed of some sort of primitive, from our point, consciousness. Or I'm just being too chauvinistic about it, and I'm looking at it from my point of view, and I'm a human, and consciousness means a very specific thing to me. But it's really hard to look at things from how can I look at something from the point of view of a rock? We can't even look at something from the point of view of a whale or a monkey.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are people who would say that those, you know, a whale or a monkey doesn't actually have consciousness because it's not fully self-aware like we are.
Oh,
you know, that they're just
they're quite self-aware.
Oh, so do I. But I mean, you'll hear people, especially, you know, even like dogs and cats, they'll say, well, they're just reacting, you know, based on instinct. They're not actually self-aware. I disagree with it.
And I can't give a specific reason right now. But
well, I feel like some recent research had come out in favor of some species of dogs having rudimentary consciousness along the lines of a 2-year-old.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I recently heard about that. They did some, I don't know if it was MRI scanning or whatever, but they figured that out. And for a while, it's been established that some of the more advanced birds, like macaws and such, have like
crows, for that matter.
Yeah. What was that?
Crows, for that matter. They're probably the smartest birds on the planet.
Yeah. Have an intellect at a similar level.
Well, look at the parrot that they taught, I don't know how many hundreds of words to, that could actually hold conversation with you.
Yeah.
And like its last words were something like be good, goodbye, or something like that.
Wow.
That's self-aware.
Yeah.
Unless they saw somebody else dying or something and they said the same thing, which I seriously doubt. I think it probably did know what was going on. There's all those, you know, who's it? Rupert Sheldrake has those experiments with parrots and dogs and all that about. You know, because he said, I read one of his papers. He said that there was it was in the Scientific Exploration Journal. It was about a African gray parrot. He said he or somebody he was studying was reading a book or a magazine, and they just turned to a page and there was a car ad, and the African gray said blue car. the thing could not see that magazine. So what the hell was going on there? And it was a blue car. He said it was a blue car. And the person just turned to that page in the magazine. Now either he's lying, or that was a coincidence, which it wasn't, because they went on to test the bird and it did the same thing, and not reliably, but multiple times.
Right.
So
that's interesting.
You know, so what is it doing there? I mean, is it that I don't even know if that's consciousness anymore. It's something completely different. You know, it knew what a car was and it knew what blue was, and you know, or at least it could tell by the person. You know, and you know, did they have glasses on? Was it reflected? No. You know, and they did it many times in many different places. But yeah, there was a psychic parrot.
Yeah, because maybe it picked up, you know, whoever was looking at it thinking blue car and just repeated it.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. But that to most people, especially the vast majority of scientists, that's ridiculous, impossible, and stupid.
And the parrot was obviously a hoaxer, you know?
Yeah, and it's a hoax.
He had a microphone there, and the owner was feeding him the information.
Yeah, which is those kinds of things have happened in the past, but, you know. What I'm going to let myself be fooled and lie to you because it's fun. It's like, no, I think these people are fairly, you know, they're fairly serious, but they're also serious about pushing the boundaries. And I love people like that, like Roger John from Pear at Princeton and Dean Rayton and you know the some of the remote viewers, etc.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the other thing. If consciousness is not confined to the body, you know, then it's not simply an organization of our systems. You know, it's not a side effect of the brain. It's not a matter of just our complex system, because it's projecting out of it.
Yeah, it's that nexus idea that Joshua brought up earlier.
Yeah. And you know, maybe when we die, we get reabsorbed into it, or maybe we stay independent of whatever we were formed from.
Yeah, that's an old idea expressed in many ways throughout the millennia. Yes.
Yeah. Because when you look at, like, the one thing with reincarnation that always fascinates me is when you have these kids who can remember clearly past lives when they're very, very young. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, well, here's a pretty solid evidence of reincarnation, unless we're all tapped into the same thing, and they're just picking up one of those many lives we're all tapped into.
Yeah, yeah. They might they may be able to, you know, borrow from the same library everybody else does.
Right. I had Julia Asante on it the first year of the show, I think, and she was talking. She would do past life regressions for people, and she knew all of her past lives and stuff. And she started regressing someone, she said, and the woman had the exact same past lives.
Hmm. Interesting.
And she said it freaked her out so much, she just kind of told the woman to leave.
Interesting.
And, you know, you think, okay, so are they the same soul existing at the same time, or are they both picking up on the same thing?
Yeah, the notion that I've been sort of fond of lately is thinking of consciousness. Well, two things. Number one, thinking of consciousness like you think of time or space, you know, it just exists, and it's not like we can manufacture it or anything. We can utilize it or tap into it, or we can something like that, but we can't create it, you know, whole cloth ourselves. But the other thing that I've been thinking about is thinking about consciousness or the collective well of souls as like a body of water, and each individual, you know, ego as a little wave compressing and, you know, rising up from this lake and receding, you know, as it goes on. But what I like about that is it's a good counter to these people who say, well, if reincarnation is all about past lives, then why do we have more people on the planet than ever? Well, shut up. It's not. You could have an infinite number of waves on a lake, but also you can have infinite waves, you know, infinite peaks and valleys on a singular wave. So maybe it's something akin to that.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One of the things, taking this back to UFOs a little bit, when I had Rick Strassman on, when he was talking about his newer book, this triggered when you said ego. So, you know, you have these like Buddhist practices of meditation that are supposed to dissolve the ego and make you, you know, one with everything. Yeah. And when Strassman was doing research after he published the first book, he found that that's not what happens with DMT. You weren't feeling absorbed into the whole. Instead, you were having a very individualistic experience.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if we connect that to UFO experiences, what's happening, you know, whatever it's telling us about reality is not, hey, be one of you know, absorb into the whole. It's telling us, no, come out further. And you have that expression you get in near-death experiences and abduction accounts where people say it was more real than real.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because it's something that's never happened to them before, so they have to reorder their ideas about what real is. And that's one of the few ways you can describe it as more real than real.
Well,
it's kind of real. It takes over your entire, like a really good piece of art, if you could do it, takes over your entire sensory apparatus.
Yeah, well, a few weeks ago when I had Sarah Lee on, I asked her what she meant by it, like if she could describe it any better. And that's kind of what she said. She said it's like everything is processing at once. It's not separated into different senses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're smelling colors and hearing sight and so on and so forth.
Yeah, synesthesia.
And it just all mixes together as a pure information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that might be what's going on in the UFO. That's something Joshua can talk about. Are the smells, you know, are the smells and the tastes and all that, do they have that kind of element to them from what you've found out?
There are plenty of examples of people experiencing odors in the astral realm. There are, interestingly enough, It's not at all uncommon for people having NDEs to experience smells, and the hedonic associations, the characteristics that they associate with the smells are strikingly consistent, actually, in terms of people going to heaven will often smell certain perfumes and fragrant flowers, and people going to hell will not always smell sulfur. Sometimes they'll smell mustiness, which is actually an interesting description that appears in some sleep paralysis reports as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's
what people smell around aliens, is a musty smell. Sometimes they give that report when they're being abducted or whatever.
Yeah, that's part of the I think some of that might have originated with Whitley, but that's a subject for another day. But I mean, this is something that people do notice, and the interesting thing is, if you look at, you know, if you look at typical explanations, like if you look at the Persinger God Helmet, only 6% of the people who reported any sort of sensations from the God Helmet actually reported smells from the God Helmet. So that number, from what I intuitively, of course, I'm not dealing with hard numbers in any of this, but from what I can intuitively discern, 6% is a lot less than people who have encounters with the unknown detect smells. And I think, from what I can tell of the NDE literature, it'll probably be lower than what people usually experience with that as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was at all helpful.
Well, I think you know, you brought up the God Helmet, and I think that's interesting, but it seems like that's like maybe just a small portion of what people are what's triggering some of these experiences, perhaps. Not that they're not real experiences, but like if an electromagnetic field could be opening us up.
Oh yeah, well, that's one of those things that I hate, is this idea of like, look, we can recreate this for lack of a better term, in a secular scientific way. You know, that must answer it. It can't be anything else but this mundane thing. Well, no, maybe that's an aspect. Maybe that's a mechanism. You know, there are a lot of different possibilities.
The believers saying, latching onto the one thing that makes sense and saying that explains everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they only recreate one single aspect of the experience, and then go on a limb and say, oh, well, then this explains everything. Just because we managed to recreate the sensation of leaving your body, oh, then this explains what happens with NDEs or OBEs.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody explain the that one where the woman saw the sneaker that was sitting on the ledge outside the hospital.
Yes.
I can't. I think somebody tried to explain that one, but I did not like the explanation. I can't remember what it was. It was very weak. I was like, no. You got to give me a better one than that. I'm not saying she left her body and that there's an afterlife and all that, but whatever the explanation was really simple-minded. It's like listening to Phil Klass explain stuff away all the time.
Well, you know, the thing too is that just because we have near-death experiences doesn't mean that's what happens when we die.
That's a great, good one, yeah.
You know, it seems to happen to specific people, or maybe only specific people who remember it, but, you know, they're not actually dying. They're coming back, so who knows what happens when we actually die.
Yeah, nobody comes and tells us that one.
Well, some people claim they do.
How? Yeah, by being reincarnated?
Well, no, channeling stuff. I talked to so-and-so, and they said, you know.
Okay, yeah, but you've got, you know, back to channeling, like we were talking about before that, but I think that anything that's coming through a human consciousness has already, before it even comes out somebody's mouth, has entered their conscious awareness, has had 100 things happen to it. That thought has had 800 different metaphors wrapped onto it before it comes out that person's mouth.
Hell, yeah, I was about to say, hell, probably on the way in. Yeah.
One of the only channeled things I ever had any appreciation for is the Seth material. And one of the reasons is, one of the first things I read about it is where Seth says, look, you know, I'm talking through the consciousness of Jane Roberts.
Right.
It's not what I'm actually saying. It's her kind of, it's going through all her filters, all her reality filters, all her biases, so on and so forth, to come out as what you're hearing. And it's never going to be exactly what I say.
Yep.
Yeah. And so it's like, okay, well, that actually makes sense. And you never hear channeled entities going on about that.
No, not really. The first thing I think of when people say, you know, what's with the channeling? Mario Pozzaglini said, I was asking him about channeling, and he said, you listen to all these people channeling, they're supposed to be doing these, like, giving you the secrets of the universe, and people are going to sleep. Because, you know, if there are any secrets of the universe in there, I think they're so, like you said, there's so much gibberish being picked up along with it that it's, that whatever, you know, the message is diluted by going through a human mind.
Right.
If there was any message coming from somewhere else, which who knows if there is or not.
Or an honest message. You know, that's the other thing, you know, the assumption that a lot of people come back to is that whatever this is telling you some sort of objective truth.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I don't know what you do with channel material. Some people run their lives on it instead of doing what they should do with any information, which is think about it, test it out for yourself, and decide if it's true or not for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so much channeled material doesn't actually have any substance to it. It's a lot of double talk, a lot of it's a lot of nothing. That was one of the things that the Seth material didn't do that I was like, okay, what am I looking at here? But at the same time, I can't say, well, there was one channeled entity ever and everything else is nonsense.
Yeah. You know, who knows? But it's hard. As soon as somebody starts getting messages, there's going to be a whole bunch of people that say, well, this is the message. And then they all start wearing the same hat and all that. And it gets very scary.
Yes.
My favorite kind of channeler would be somebody that would say, get away from me. I have nothing to say. Stop believing what I'm saying. What is wrong with you? And then just keep going.
Huh.
So basically you want Brian from Life of Brian.
Yes.
Channeling Brian.
Yeah, because the exact same thing would happen with, you know.
and Kiel had pointed out too that a lot of the contactees were getting similar messages to people who were channeling.
Yeah.
And it all seems to be layered down with tricksterisms and just weird nonsense mixed in.
Yeah. It's never anything that useful, and it's always, and if it does get really weird, it's often things that are kind of disturbing and frightening. And that's when you should really start figuring out what you're doing. Because I don't know if that's coming from, you know, evil demons or whatever, but it's certainly turning you into somebody who thinks it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I call them.
Have I not drank coffee in a while? I'm not making sense now, right?
No. All right. Any other directions we should go with this?
Here's a heretic question. Do you think that your followers should stop trying to attain respectability?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it should care.
I
agree also. I think that the power of your followers, ufology is that it's not respected or part of the mainstream. You know, I think that you get to influence society more potently, but remaining in the outlier, you know, always in the periphery of society.
Yeah, but nobody notices till later, and so your ego isn't struck, so why do that?
And if it becomes a mainstream thing, then it's going to become even more dogmatized than it already is, because there's going to be the acceptable theories and the non-acceptable theories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody – I was just thinking about this when you were talking about the MUFON people. I think a lot of these people were weirdos to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So – why are they trying, you know, why, not these people specifically, but maybe more in the past, why are they trying, you know, are they still trying to get back at the guy that kicked sand in their face or whatever? It's like, well, this is real and I found it out and you thought I was a big geek. And it's like, you know, that absolutely, you know, if you're a weirdo to begin with, I think that's your strength.
Yeah.
So follow that weirdness and, you know, and use that as the guide and throw the ego out the door. You know, that probably be that's another big problem with a lot of the research into anything, not just UFOs, but, you know, people's egos get in the way. It's like, I found this thing, or, you know, this is my opinion, or, you know, I told you so. You know, that's what all that's what a lot of the disclosure people want to say. And they'll never, ever, ever be able to say that. I am almost certain of that.
Yeah.
They'll never be an I told you so. In fact, most of ufology, I don't think they'll ever be an I told you so. And the problem is that the loudest people have that attitude, I think. All the people that are really interested in the thing and are going, like we said at the beginning, are going about it quietly and really want to know what's going on, or maybe even more importantly, learn the things while they're trying to figure out what's going on. Those are the people where I think some answers will come. And it may be individual answers. It may be something that applies to everybody, which isn't very useful, but, you know, it's a good thing.
And the meek shall inherit the earth.
Well, if there are individual answers for everyone, and then we can stop looking for one that fits everyone.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think I might be the lone voice of dissension. I think that we should stop pursuing respectability because it's unattainable. But at the same time, I don't think we should ever stop trying to win over hearts and minds of individuals. And getting people to treat things this with some degree of seriousness or some degree of, you know, straight-facedness.
Yeah. Oh, great. Can you guys hear the helicopter out there?
Barely.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Barely. I wondered how loud it was. I'm in L.A., so every once in a while a helicopter will circle.
Great.
What are they called? I can't remember. Ghetto birds. Although I'm not into ghetto. But yeah, that's what the circling helicopters in LA are called.
You know, anything that rises to a mainstream level is always going to be kind of tiered down by it a little bit.
Yes.
And I think, you know, like the level the paranormal stuff is at now with the TV shows and stuff is probably as big as it's ever going to get toward the mainstream.
God, I hope so.
Yeah, and I think it's okay where it is simply because it brings people in who are interested and who may have been afraid to admit they were interested till the stuff got popular on TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it creates a culture that's more accepting of, oh, you're interested in ghosts or you're interested in aliens or you're interested in UFOs. And it creates that okayness where people can talk about it.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I did not know anybody else interested in this stuff. Not one person I knew cared about it. I was the only one. And now if I go and talk at a school, everybody's interested in it.
Yeah.
Which is good. That's great.
But they're all riding that ETH bandwagon, you know?
That's fine, because there'll be a couple outliers that go, hey, wait a second, and then, you know, in 1, 2, 5, 10, or 20 years they're gonna break it open. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, but the question is, so even if we get rid of the ET idea, is it just going to be replaced with the next idea that fits the zeitgeist of the time?
Yeah, you know, it's already happening. I mean, I think the ufology has been slowly moving away from the ETH and embracing ideas like, I don't know, parallel universes.
Right. But I mean, I wonder if the UFO phenomena represents something that we can never actually understand on a one-on-one basis. It's just always going to be behind a different mask. We may get a little deeper or we may understand it a little different, but it's always going to be behind that mask. We'll never see what it really is.
Yeah, that's my suspicion.
Yeah, the only way to get by that possibly is to look at how we're looking at it.
Right.
And to trick ourselves into looking in a place that we wouldn't have looked or thinking it. I think if there is some sort of an answer, it'll be a total accident and a completely not what anybody expects and nothing to do with what most people are concentrating on. And all that'll take is either an accident or a concerted effort not to, you know, not to go in a certain direction, I guess, or go in a completely wacko direction. See, you know, that makes no sense at all logically, but maybe makes sense intuitively, and that might be it. I think, you know, we're doing that. What's the Fordian quote? Picking up an existence by its frogs.
Mm. Nice. All right. Anything else, guys? Anything else you want to bring up before we end this?
Plenty. I can't think of any right now.
All right. Well, you can always come back.
We got to save something for next time.
Yeah, exactly. Has to be a sequel.
All right.
Oh, it would never end. We could keep going.
Huh?
It would never end. We anytime I get talking with people like you guys, it could keep going for hours, and sometimes it does.
When is your book out, Greg?
I don't know, but I'm going to try and get it out before the UFO conference in middle of February. I don't know how doable that is. I'm still doing the editing, but that's a goal. So within a month or two, very, very soon.
All right, cool. And where are people going to be able to pick it up?
I don't know. I'm doing it through Lulu, so I think it's going to be available on Lulu, and I think there's a provision to have it on Amazon too. And then within probably a few months afterwards, after the hard copy stop selling so much, I will make a ebook Kindle out of it and add some more stuff.
Nice. All right. And people can listen to Radio Mysterioso, your podcast, where?
At RadioMysterioso.com, and I'm not sure if I'll be doing the live shows too much longer because of we might lose the studio. I don't know yet, but I will keep doing the show no matter what. I'm going to have in 4 days. I'm going to interview Chris Aubeck,
nice.
the guy that wrote Wonders in the Sky with Vallée,
with Jacques Vallée. Yeah.
And another one more recently. So I've that's who's on with me next. But yeah, it's not going to be a live show because we can't. He lives in Spain, so I think I might be going the way of most podcasts and not doing them as much live until I set it up at my house here, and then I can do them live from my desk.
Nice. All right. And Joshua, your book is done?
Yeah, my follow up to A Trojan Feast has gone through its second draft and is in the hands of some very competent readers. So that should be, I'm aiming to get it. I'm thinking probably it'll be available in June. So stay tuned for updates at joshuacutchin.com.
All right. Anything you got to promote, Red Pill?
Nope.
Well, you did the artwork for Greg's book, right?
Oh yeah. I'm very proud of that. You know, I hope that
should
people
be. It's beautiful.
We'll get a kick out of it.
Yeah, you shared some of that with us, and it was amazing.
Yeah, one day that was very intentional about this. Fill it with a lot of Easter eggs that I hope that will only be understood by a cadre of people.
Yeah, it looks great.
All right, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Bye-bye.